And my name is David House, and we're talking today with Kevin Hayes, who is pianist and composer and lives up in Santa Fe. How are you?
I'm fine. It's great to be here.
Yeah, good. Good to have you, man.
Thank you.
Kevin has played with, I was telling them just before we started, played with just about everybody that I care about. initially from New York City, right?
Yeah, I was born in New York. I was raised in Connecticut, just about an hour north of New York City in a town called Greenwich, Connecticut, and went to high school there and then moved, I guess I could say back to New York. I was just born there. I never lived there, but right out of high school in 86 when I graduated high school.
Okay. And how did you start with jazz? How did that come into your life?
Well, my father played some piano when I was growing up, not professionally, but he would play popular songs of, you know, his day, George Gershwin and Cole Porter. And apparently he played, had a little radio show at one point when he was growing up in Ohio. And in any event, I would hear him playing, so I suppose that had some early influence on me. They had a few jazz records, not too many. They had maybe some George Shearing and Oscar Peterson, but that was certainly enough to get me started and catch the bug. Although I didn't start at first with jazz per se. I mean, when I first started taking piano lessons when I was about 6 years old.
Okay.
With what everybody starts with, you know, the big notes and Kitten on the Keys kind of thing, and I guess when I was about 14 or so, I started to sort of get the jazz bug. And
well, when did that happen? I mean, what was it that you said you had some of that music around the house? So you're obviously exposed. And let me ask you, too. You said you graduated in what, 88?
86.
86.
Guess it was, yeah.
Okay,
yeah.
And that makes you.
So I'm 37.
You're 37 now.
38 in May.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. And to have played with so many people.
Wow.
Damn you.
Lucky guy.
So anyway, the whole, the influence of jazz when you were a teenager, what really kind of, do you have an event or a particular memory of the influence of jazz when you were a teenager?
I remember, I mean, one of my earliest recordings that I ever heard. I don't know how this recording made it into the house, but somehow we had a Jimmy Smith record called Organ Grinder Swing. And I remember, it had like Satin Doll, old cliche tunes on it, but it was so swinging, it was just the feeling of the music, just got in me, mm-hmm. And I remember that being kind of a pivotal moment, for me when I thought, ooh, this is really great. I would like to do something like this. When I first started taking jazz piano, which was with a jazz pianist who died a few years ago by the name of Lou Stein, who was a old session musician back in the 40s. In fact, he's on that Charlie Parker with Strings album, so sort of his claim to fame.
Mm-hmm.
And he was my first teacher. As it turns out, my father took lessons at the same time I was taking lessons, so we would go up there and take lessons not at the same time, but one after the other up in upstate New York, not far from where I grew up.
That must have been a bit of a bonding experience.
Yeah, it was interesting. It was like talking chords. You get this? No, not quite.
Well, that's cool.
And then another pivotal experience was when I went to Interlock in music camp in the summer. I spent a few years there, and
That's in upstate Michigan.
Yeah, exactly. Near Traverse City, right? So I went there and took sort of a crash course in jazz voicings and piano by a teacher by the name of Charles Argersinger, who I think taught at DePaul University. Anyway, I was a total beginner at that point. But I remember calling home from one of these summers. It might have been my first one there. I was maybe, I don't know, 13 or 14 years old. And I just said, you know, I remember calling my parents and just saying, you know, I can't imagine doing anything else. This is it.
That's cool. You know? That's cool. What was their reaction to that?
I think, you know, they always supported it, you know, and they, mm-hmm. I mean.
Did they support it or did they support it?
No, they really did. I mean, they loved music and, you know, I guess at a certain point when I was young, some teacher said, you know, this kid has a gift, you know, and you should, you know,
nurture
help
them.
Him out.
That's,
you
cool.
Know?
That's cool.
So it was really great.
That's cool. That's
yeah,
really
that
cool.
Way.
So take us from your education that you were referring to, you know, the Interlochen camp and you know, I don't think we talked much about much after that. Mm. Like, what's the bridge from that early enthusiasm for the music and your early demonstration of skill to playing at a very high level in New York City?
Mm.
I mean, not blow by blow, but just sort of right. like the arc of how that happened for you.
Well, I mentioned my first piano teacher. I mean, I was a young kid, you know, Lou Stein was my first jazz piano teacher. Then when I was in a sophomore in high school, I started studying with a jazz pianist and composer by the name of Jack Riley, who had several students in New York. And I would take the train in and go and study with Jack, who I believe I met through Bill Charlap, who's a jazz pianist in New York and great player and recording artist on Blue Note and made some really nice records. And we were very close friends, meeting through mutual friends when I was still in Connecticut and was starting to travel into New York. And from there, I left Jack to study. Well, let me fill in another blank. When I graduated high school, I went to Manhattan School of Music, and I spent a semester at Manhattan School of Music. The reason it turned into a semester was that I got an offer to go to Europe, to go to Spain with a band from New York, with a drummer by the name of Tony Moreno, who had done some, you know, had been on the scene for a while and had lived in Spain for a while, and he took a band over there. So I wound up going to Spain when I was 19 and to play, and actually went to Germany as well to play with a bass player who had set up some work that I had met at Manhattan School of Music too, by the name of Dieter Ilg.
Did that seem extraordinary to you to be playing in Europe at 19?
Oh yeah, it was fantastic. I mean, I was so excited, you know. I mean, I was going to be able to just do what I love to do, you know, which was play, and of course to see Europe, and it was an incredible experience, just totally eye opening, you know. This, it's
like what?
Well, I mean, just to be exposed to a completely different culture, you know, a totally different way of life, you know, than I was accustomed to in Spain, you know, everything from the food to just everything was completely new, right. And exciting. And of course, to be there as a jazz musician, as to be playing, was just heaven, you know. So I wound up spending about 3 months in Europe at that time. And when I came back home, I decided that I wasn't going to return to school. I did return to Connecticut for a little while to kind of regroup. And before moving to New York again and settling there.
Okay, so now you're early 20s, right? Settling in New York, and trying to make a living as a jazz player.
Right. I'll mention also that my last sort of teacher wound up being a classical teacher, a classical pianist, who was actually also recommended to me by Bill Charlap. I studied this particular technique that was pioneered by a woman by the name of Dorothy Taubman, just quite an efficient way of playing the instrument. So I worked with her for several years, during my later years of high school into, you know, I still consider her my teacher, you know, Eleanor Hancock. And from there, you know, I mean, it's just a sort of a matter of sticking around New York for me, and meeting musicians and playing jam sessions, and word of mouth is kind of the way it works in New York. You know, if you get together and this guy says, "Oh, you should check out this guy," and this, you know, call this guy for a gig, and this guy, "Hey, this guy plays well," and this,
and they don't pass around recommendations unless you can play.
Well, yeah, so, you know. Yeah.
So, and that's how it works, is what.
Basically, yeah. You know, you don't go into a jam session with your degree on your.
Yeah.
You know, you go in. How do you play? You know right. what I mean. And so it was sort of unfolding like that, where one of the earlier bands I played in was the Harper Brothers band, which is these two. Young guys from Atlanta, and I guess D.C. and Atlanta, trumpet player and a drummer, Winard Harper and Philip, and they were hot stuff in the early 90s, and joined their band. From there, got recommended, I think, by another pianist, Stephen Scott, who was working at times with the Harper Brothers, and also Benny Golson, and I wound up doing a gig with Benny Golson at some crazy Italian restaurant up in Yonkers, New York, with a drummer that made the tomato sauce and played real loud, and so then Benny started calling me for gigs, and it's a network, and
right.
you know, not unlike other.
Some of our players who have gone through this surviving in New York experience sort of have described it differently. You know, they have a range of experiences where there's anxious moments, and there's like periods where you're not sure if it's going to break or that you're going to be able to make it. You know, can you sketch out sort of the emotional roller coaster that you went through, or did it go differently for you?
Well, I mean, living in New York and having to pay the rent and the whole, the whole, is this going to work out? But I guess I feel very fortunate, you know, that I had the experiences that I had, and that, people were interested, you know, in what I was doing, and seemed to be attracted to the music that I was able to do, you know, that I was able to make. And so I feel really blessed, you know, to have had those experiences. And believe me, I mean, there's a whole lot of pinching going on, you know. Like, is this really yeah. happening? You know what right. I mean? This is self-pinching, you know, like the first time Cho Henderson called me, I mean, it was just like, you know, I remember I was living with Bill Stewart at the time, and I came home one evening and he said, "Joe called." And I said, "Joe who?" He said, "Joe Henderson." I said, "Come on, man. Don't do that. Don't lie to me." But I checked the machine and I heard, you know, right, this is Joe. I don't know if you're in town or out of town." He had a certain thing that he would say, you know, and he's sort of a character. And next thing I knew, you know, I was on an airplane going flying to San Diego to play with Joe Henderson. And I, this can't be happening. You know, it's just incredible, you know. So, but that's not to say that there weren't times, you know, where the bank account was empty, you know, and I had to scrape and, you know, play weddings and, you know, do all the sort of mundane things that that musicians have to do, you know, mm-hmm. to fill in those spaces, you know, at times. And But I feel very, very fortunate, you know, to have had the opportunities that I've had.
So you've had a bunch of influences. Is any particular one that really stands out that has helped you make a decision about what type of jazz or where you wanted to go with it? Or
mm-hmm. Well, I went through certain several phases of jazz piano players that I, you know, that I were my idols, you know. In the beginning, it was Oscar Peterson, and probably after that, Phineas Newborn was a guy that I really enjoyed listening to and tried to emulate, and Herbie Hancock. Bill Evans was a big, inspiration and influence on me. There were really also Wynton Kelly was another one,
mm-hmm.
Who I probably first heard through listening to Miles Davis records. Interestingly, you know, the first time I heard Miles, again, a Miles Davis record wound up in my house.
For some reason.
No, because I say that because, you know, my parents' listening tastes were fairly conservative, you know. Now, somehow, the record Four and More wound up. I think it was my oldest brother. I seem to remember finding it in his room, you know.
Mm-hmm.
I would go scouring his record collection and finding all kinds of goodies, you know, mm-hmm. From Miles to Jeff Beck and fusion stuff, you know, and rock stuff and things that I didn't have exposure to necessarily, you know. But I remember hearing Four and More, Miles Davis album, which is the fast songs from the Carnegie Hall concert. I guess it was early 60s. I don't know what it was, maybe 63 or something, whenever the beginning of that band with George Coleman and I remember putting that on and really actually being very confused by it and disliking it, actually. I thought this is – because I was used to listening to, you know, kind of music that was a little more groove-oriented, and mm-hmm. his stuff was super fast and I didn't get it. And I said, this isn't swinging, you know. Mm-hmm. So, you know, it took me a second to sort of adjust to that and realize, of course, how great it was. I mean, that's a pretty – it actually is a fairly raw record,
sure.
if you think about it.
Sure.
If you go back and listen to it. But that may have been an early introduction to Herbie too, you know.
So you brought some – Miles with you.
Yeah.
You brought a track.
Yeah. I brought something off of Miles Smiles, the quintet with Tony Williams and Ron Carter and Wayne Shorter. Actually, as I was bringing it down here, I realized this was their second record, which seems hard to believe. It's like so seems so developed, you know what I mean? But I guess when Miles put those guys together who were already obviously playing together to a certain extent, you know, but still they were all fairly young, you know.
Mm-hmm. Well, why was this music important to you?
You know, probably there's so many elements to it that have inspired me. Not the least of which was Miles himself, you know, who, as free as that music was, the way he played it, and with the lyricism, you know, and his, of course, his sound and his phrasing, you know, I just realized how, I mean, I was just listening to it on the way down here, you know, and I thought, this is so rare. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? This is the reason that guys aren't walking around on this planet. You know, this is not easy. You know what I mean? And whatever those elements were that he was gifted with, you know, just in that particular music, I brought the tune "Orbits" from the record, and she's just playing so incredibly beautifully. You know, and. I think maybe the other elements that were appealing to me was the kind of freedom and but also the control, incredible control, you know, that all of those musicians had, because you had the sort of freedom movement, you know, with Ornette and Eric Dolphy that would come maybe a little later than that, but you know. I guess maybe we would come a little later, but and it seemed like the younger musicians in the band, you know, were experimenting with that stuff, and like Wayne, and I mean, I think most of the tunes, if not all of them, are Wayne's songs,
right?
You know, on that record, you know, of course, just everyone's just playing incredibly well, you know?
Yeah. Yeah, Wayne Shorter was in town just a few years ago in Albuquerque, and that was the sort of experience. There was this free thing going on there, and everyone was playing like the most amazing way. It was some people I don't think could handle it, but it was really wonderful. I want to ask you too, of the piano players that you were talking about. Was there a particular thing about each one of them as you kind of went through that really kind of challenged you, or just said, you know, how does he do that?
Right. Yeah. Like for instance, Herbie, you know, as I was sort of studying how he put things together, I was intrigued by his lyricism, you know, like if he was playing a ballad, how he sounded so free and didn't lose the time as he was doing this free type phrasing over it. And I realized, much like one of my teachers indicated to me when I was working on some classical music, or even as I was working on playing a jazz piece for her, you know, she reminded me that rubato is not without time. It's flexible. It's breathing, you know. And so the way that someone like Herbie would stretch the time, you know, over the bar. I mean, for me, I was always inclined towards the lyrical, you know, I would go through phases that necessarily, you know, when I think of someone like Chick Corea, you know, who's a great player, you know, I don't necessarily think of lyricism. You know, when I think of Herbie or Bill Evans, I think of lyricism. You
okay.
know? Or a certain extent, Keith Jarrett, you know what I mean? So I would sort of try and analyze what he was doing, you know, and see, well, how is he accomplishing this, you know? And there were other, like you say, other pianists who I would say, well, from an improvisational standpoint, noticing that Wynton Kelly, for instance, in listening to his playing, whether it was his own records or with Miles Davis, one of my favorite records was Miles Davis at the Black Hawk in, I guess that was in Chicago,
mm-hmm.
Live at the Black Hawk with Hank Mobley and Jimmy Cobb and Paul Chambers. Great band,
mm-hmm.
you know. Anyway, you know, I thought, man, it seems like Wynton could just start a phrase on any note he wanted. It didn't matter what the chord was. And I thought, I didn't know that was legal. You know, I didn't know you could do that. And so you're right. You take a little piece from this guy and a little piece from that guy, and you say, wow, I love how he does that, and I'd like to do mm-hmm. that, you know. And so.
Oh, that's interesting. Really interesting.